which put him into a steep turn that robbed his canopy of air. He turned 180 degrees and was now landing into the wind, which should have slowed his forward progress. Instead, the wind gusted harder as it raced through the saddle, threatening to blow him backward over the cliff. He pulled as hard as he could with one arm, effectively stalling the chute so that he would crash into the side of the mountain rather than into the water. The move sent him into a steep left turn from which there was no recovery. His feet touched the mountainside and his body went flipping across the snowy face like a downhill skier crashing out of control. He felt his nods rip from his helmet and felt the receiver of his AR burst apart, despite the tape intended to hold it together. After what seemed like an eternity of tumbling through snow, rocks, and ice, his canopy again filled with a gust of wind, dragging him over the rough ground. Reaching up, he frantically searched for the release to arrest his momentum. Got it! The world was suddenly still and quiet. Shit, that hurt. Reese lay still, looking up at the sky, feeling the cold snow on his back. He started with his toes. He could feel them, which was a good sign. He then bent his knees and arched his back. Cautiously, he twisted his spine. Then he wiggled his fingers, moved his elbows, and slowly turned his head from side to side before pushing himself up into a sitting position and reaching for the Eccles rifle, which had survived the fall. Frogman luck. Reese stood up stiffly and slid the Eccles from its padded case, observing his immediate surroundings. His nods were gone, but his helmet was still attached to his head and had probably helped save his life. His first-line gear was still attached to his body, which meant he had his pistol and blades. Without a working light to check his sniper rifle, he used his fingers to explore the familiar weapon system. Barrel, scope, stock, sling. Everything was in place. Whether it retained its zero remained to be seen. Gazing up at the mountains, he pulled out a small compass to get his bearings. He was alone, in enemy territory, without a working radio, and needed to rendezvous with his team. Their loss of comms link-up point was just a mile to the southeast. There was no sign of any other human life. He was alive and had a mission to complete. Alone, in a foreign land, he moved off into the night. I am never out of the fight. Chapter 72. Medny Island, Russia. Captain Karyavin Vasilyevich joined his men on the high ground and checked their position, arranged overlooking a choke point along the most likely avenue of approach to Deputy Director Alexander Zharkov's lodge. He'd shut down the tactical EMP and patrolled to the ambush site with his seven-man team, all combat veterans of Russia's forays into its former territories over the past decade. It would take 20 minutes for the EMP to rejuvenate and store enough power for another shot, but by that time, the Americans would be on the ground wondering why their high-tech gear was fried. They needed that deadly advantage over the Americans, whose technological superiority would now be reduced to useless pieces of wires and metal. The United States had outpaced their old adversary in technological advances since the fall of the Soviet Union. The new Russian Federation could stamp out machine parts and build the ever-reliable AK, but when it came to the weapons of the information age, computers and microchips, Russia was not even in the running. That meant they had to focus on how to eliminate the technological advantages of their enemies. Though export restricted, the nods and lasers that adorned the team's M4s were purchased in the United States, legally, by Alexander Zharkov's illegals. They were then dismantled and smuggled into Russia, using the deputy director's Bratva network to supply his private security detail with the best weapons and optics available. Night vision tubes were disguised inside binoculars, and M4s were disassembled and disguised as machine parts, then reassembled once safely inside the borders of Mother Russia. The one sniper in the group cradled a Chukovin rifle chambered in 7.62 by 54R in his arms. A recent replacement for the revered Cold War-era Dragunov, he knew the Schmittenbender optic that graced its top rail was not what soldiers in the Russian military would be using. The expensive scopes were for demonstrations and show purposes. True to form, the bureaucrats would ensure that the ground pounders would be given suboptimal glass so that more of them could be fielded. What was it Stalin had said about quantity? No matter. He had his rifle, scope, and a U.S.-made forward-mounted night optic along with an IR laser. He would have preferred the Orsis T-5000 Tochnost in 338 Lapua, but that could not be helped. He'd send more than a few insurgents to their graves in Chechnya and Dagestan from behind the iconic-looking Dragunov, though having spent so much time with it, he knew the effective range only extended that of the AK by 300 meters. This new Kalashnikov-concerned Chukovin was different. With it, he'd kill his first American. Vasilyevich's men had emplaced MON-50 anti-personnel devices just minutes earlier on what amounted to the choke point at the most likely avenue of approach to the lodge. Though the men had no personal experience with the American Claymore mine, they knew the MON-50 was their country's equivalent and had seen their devastating effectiveness in combat in Chechnya and the North Caucasus. His former soldiers knew their trade. Most important, they possessed the element of surprise and had taken away the technological advantages of their opposition. Anyone the explosives didn't eviscerate would be systematically gunned down by his team. Now it was time to watch and wait. Alexander was awake at 3 o'clock a.m., admiring the falling snow. The Buran snowmobile was gassed up and was idling next to the Kamaz 6x6 in the detached garage. Sergei's new dogs were not yet at the level of the two the Hastings woman had killed, though they were showing promising attributes. He'd shunned alcohol at dinner, as was his custom the night before a hunt, but still hadn't slept well. The anticipation overpowered his need for sleep. That worried him some. He wanted to be at his best. The team coming to kill him would be slaughtered on their approach, thanks to the intelligence from Grant LaRue and his lackey in the executive branch. The lobbyists lived and operated in plain sight, right under the noses of the Americans. The lobbying industry had been ripe for exploitation by the SVR. What to do with the bodies? As the National Deputy Director of Clandestine Services, he could turn this into a major international incident and push the United States and Russia to the brink of war. But what good would that do? There was a smarter, back-channel move to make. Later. Focus on the hunt. He'd hoped to somehow capture Commander Reese alive, but the odds of capturing any of the American force alive were slim. He might make an even more formidable adversary than his friend who waited one floor below, nourished but cold and, more important, inspired. His sister's head in a formaldehyde jar to keep him company all night should have given him all the incentive needed to make this Alexander's most challenging and pleasurable adventure to date. It was time to hunt. Chapter 73. Medny Island, Russia. Everyone else on the team felt like they were back in the Dark Ages. Everyone but Reese. He was in his element. He'd grown up in the mountains with his father, who passed along the importance of map and compass work, terrain association, taking bearings, and triangulation. Their GPS devices, lasers, and nods might be down, but that didn't mean that these warriors were out of the fight. They reconsolidated at the link-up point. Reese was the last to arrive, the others having managed to land in the same general vicinity. Being most familiar with the routes and objective, Reese took dual point with Devon and Ido. The Belgian Malinois was off-leash and alert, back doing what he'd been trained for. Much like the men he accompanied, Ito had been out of the fight too long and was ready for action. Eli and Farkas followed, with Chavez taking rear security. The lack of nods meant they had to patrol closer together than they were accustomed to. They all knew the threat of being too close if a rocket, mortar, or IED hit. They hadn't jumped snowshoes. Intel suggested the snow covering was light. But reality on the ground was different than it looked from satellites 100 miles up. Even enveloped by darkness over the snow-covered ground, the team moved with purpose toward their objective. Their plan was to hit the lodge, grab Hannah and Rafe, make it to extract, and kill anyone who got in their way. Reese knew it was a bit harebrained. If he were still a SEAL, there was no way he would greenlight 5 assaulters and a dog hitting a lodge on an island off the coast of Siberia. He also knew that if the situation were reversed, Rafe would move heaven and earth to get him out. They were committed. They were going in. Devon froze. He raised his left hand in a fist at head level. He gave Ito the command to halt. "Blif," he hissed in Dutch, following it with an immediate, "Here." Ito returned to Devon's left side, going prone on the snow, waiting for the next command. Devon had noticed the dog's body language change. It was something only those in tune with their partner would sense. His ears moved forward, his gait became more aggressive, and his tail changed its rhythmic wag ever so slightly. His next move would have been to finish or find the IED. Ito had not forgotten the ways of war. Neither had Devon. He did not want his dog to finish, which meant sitting right at the IED. Certain death. The team sank to their knees.
"Explosives ahead," Devon said under his breath.
"Are you sure?" Reese asked, already knowing the answer.
"Positive," Ito alerted on it. "Lucky we were coming in from downwind, or we might have walked right past it."
"How far?"
"Hard to tell exactly, but in these conditions, 50 to 100 yards.
Ito's head snapped up again, ears erect, body stiff and ready to launch, looking ahead at an angle.
"Ambush,"
Devon declared. Reese was squinting into the darkness when the first round took him square in the chest. Chapter 74. Devon hit the ground and sent 10 rounds in the direction of the ambush before yelling, "Contact front!" "Plots!" he yelled at Ito over the sound of his rifle, ensuring Ito would stay down and by his side. "Online!" Eli low crawled toward Reese, Devon, and Ito, elbows sinking into the snow, digging in with his knees and feet to propel himself forward. In the darkness, they didn't have targets, and he'd only caught the slightest hint of a muzzle flash as he hit the deck moments earlier.
Suppressors.
Firing from their aggressors ceased. They had been on a slight incline, and the fact that they weren't all dead meant that Ito had kept them out of the kill zone. If they stayed down, they were below the enemy's line of sight, meaning they were endefileed.
"Win the fight," Eli thought. "Hard to do with nothing to shoot at."
Farkas was by his side in an instant. They grabbed Reese by his pant leg and began dragging him back toward a rock formation protruding from the snow behind. Devon pushed himself back, close behind, Ito low-crawling right along with him toward their rear security.
"I have an out," he whispered, guiding the rest of the team to the rock behind him.
Devon and Farkas helped form a perimeter around their wounded leader as Eli went to work assessing his patient, running his hands up and down Reese's body, feeling for severe bleeding and massive injuries. As he went to check for breathing, Reese's eyes opened wide.
"I'm okay. I'm okay," he said, coughing.
"Quiet, brother," Eli responded. "You just took a round to the chest. Must have hit your head when you fell."
Reese's hand went to his chest and felt the pieces of ceramic plate that had split into fragments, absorbing the bullet's impact just as it was designed.
"Well, this thing is useless now," Reese observed, struggling out of his plate carrier and tossing his magazines to Eli. "Where's my rifle?" "Here you go, boss," Devon said. He'd grabbed the Eccles legend on his crawl back to the rock.
Thanks. Okay. What do we have?
Shooting stopped right after you were hit. Looks like they were set up with IEDs, mines, or an anti-personnel explosive device of some sort. We must be out of their line of sight here, but I'd wager they are maneuvering on us right now. That shot that took you was accurate. I'd guess they have NODs and suppressors, possibly IR lasers.
Shit.
Devon turned in toward the former SEAL commander. Ito will let us know when they're coming. Rafe and Hannah were to the west. Extract was a few hours out to the east. They were pinned down on an enemy island where their adversary held the technical and tactical advantages.
Think, Reese.
Take a breath, look around, make a call. He looked at the men around him. They were all there to help Rafe and Hannah, but they wouldn't have put their lives on the line unless Reese had asked. He looked back at the rifle in his hands. Wood stock, Night Force optic, similar to what his father had used in Vietnam, only more accurate. That was it. Vietnam.
Bring it in,
Reese whispered, the others scooting in closer so they could hear the combat-tested leader.
Do you still have your flare guns?
The ones we were to use in a loss of comms emergency extract to signal the bird? Heads nodded around the circle.
Okay, then. We are going to take their advantage and even things up. The Vietnam guys who taught me had to fight at night without night vision. They had to turn night into day. We're going to do the same thing, but we have to do it fast.
Hands were already going into kits and removing the small nautical flare guns Thorne had given them before they departed.
It's not like the 40-millimeter flares we had in the teams, but it's all we have. I'm going to move to high ground just north, that hill we passed a couple hundred yards back. If my map study is correct, it should put me in a position slightly above theirs. If they flank us or start coming in, let the dog go and start putting up those flares and engaging. If I can get to high ground, I'll fire my flare and start putting them down.
Time it right. We only have about 5 seconds per flare, so this is going to happen fast. How many flares per gun?
2,
Eli answered.
Okay.
I'll initiate with one of mine. As one flare goes out, put up another. Do not put two up at the same time. It's going to be close as it is. If they are moving in on us, we will have them in an L ambush.
Let me come with you, Eli pleaded. Negative, you stay here. I need 3 of you on the guns and 1 of you putting up those flares. Besides, I work better alone these days.
Reese looked around the circle, and though they couldn't see it, he smiled. He was a sniper, and he was going to high ground. Chapter 75. Reese pushed himself forward at a full sprint, no small feat over snow-covered ground in the dark. He hadn't been shot in the back yet, which meant the enemy couldn't see him. An even darker shape appeared out of the darkness. The hill was just to his left. Reese veered toward it and began to climb. It was steep enough that the snow only held to the more horizontal ledges. His feet slid out from under him as he worked his way up the scree, thin pieces of rock causing him to slide back a step with every 2 he took forward. Slinging his rifle across his back, he grabbed at anything that would give him purchase, his hot breath visible in the cold, early morning air.
Keep moving forward, he heard his dad's voice urging him on. Always improve your fighting position, son.
His legs burned and he felt the rocks and ice tearing at his hands. Up he went, continuing his scramble.
Almost.
There it was, his sniper's perch beckoned. Sliding into an elevated position above those moving in to kill his team, Reese unslung his rifle and flipped up the scope covers before going prone and setting the flare gun to his right. He was about to find out what they faced. Stock to shoulder, cheek to its rest, body nestled in among the rocks and ice, safety off. Reese reached for the flare gun, cocked it, pointed it skyward over what he estimated was the enemy position, and pulled the trigger. Vasilyevich watched his flanking element approach the enemy's suspected position. They moved in slowly, weapons up, scanning the terrain before them.
Even with the advantage of the nods, the ground was treacherous and the Americans were armed.
How had they identified the MON-50s right before they entered the kill zone? They must have a dog with them fucking dogs.
The flanking element would have them in sight any moment now. A popping noise to his left took his attention from the scene below, and a second later his nods erupted in bright white. Reese was on the gun and on the trigger when his first flare illuminated the ground below. He'd been slightly off on his estimation of where the opposing force's base element would be situated, but not by much. Without a laser rangefinder, Reese estimated distance by one of the ways he'd been taught almost 20 years before. He used a map study. Actual distance to target, 550 yards. Altitude, temperature, velocity, bore height, ballistic coefficient of the 300 Win Mag Barnes TTSX. Elevated at a 35-degree incline. 2 mil adjustment for a 39.5-inch drop. Wind approximately 5 miles an hour. Full value, 8.5-inch hold right. Reese made the adjustments in his head and pressed the trigger, sending 180 grains of Barnes triple shock through the spine of the far-left shooter. Quickly throwing the bolt, Reese chambered his second round and let it fly. He aimed at the upper torsos of his targets, the bullet's nose peeling back instantly on contact into a copper petal of death, tearing through the heart and lungs of his second target. A third soldier was struggling to get into a kneeling position, suddenly aware that two of his teammates were no longer of the earth, when Reese's third bullet took him high in the chest. The bullet ripped through the breastplate and eviscerated both lungs before exiting out the back, removing an even larger chunk of flesh on the way out. Reese had been so focused on eliminating the base element and had thrown the bolt so fast that he hadn't even noticed the flares start going up to his left. When his team's suppressed shots began penetrating the night air, Reese could tell the plan was working. They'd turned night into day. All they had to do was just not miss. If the Russians survived the initial onslaught, they would be back on top with their nods and lasers. Reese's team would get only one chance. He'd seen five figures in prone when his first flare had illuminated the landscape.
How many have my team sent up? Don't worry about them right now. Do your job.
Reese reached for the flare gun, grabbed his second and last round from its rail, and broke the action, only to find the spent shell didn't eject on its own. Grabbing it with his numb fingers, he pulled it from the gun, fumbled, and dropped his last flare into the abyss. Chapter 76. Vasilyevich and the last living member of his base element rolled out of what they quickly recognized as a kill zone. Whoever was shooting at them was good. In 3 or 4 seconds, he'd taken out more than half his force. Luckily, the Wagner Group team leader still had his sniper.
How many flares did they have?
Recognizing that the tables had turned, Vasilyevich focused his attention on the cliffs to the northeast from behind the boulder before him and motioned to his sniper.
The cliffs! He's in the cliffs! He hissed.
The sniper had been set up to shoot down on the approaching force from the high ground and had moved from a prone to a sitting position that would allow him to find his new target in the cliffs above. The night optic was good, but at a distance it was almost impossible to discern an unmoving camouflaged figure from the jagged mountainside.
There,
Vasilyevich saw a slight movement against a still backdrop.
500 meters, halfway up the rocks,
he yelled at the sniper to make sure he knew where to shoot. Vasilyevich directed his M4 at his new target, lasers dancing in and around the location of the movement, and began to fire. Reese's heart sank as his final flare dropped out of sight, bouncing off the rock face and falling into the darkness below.
Shit! My teammates are counting on me. Think, Reese. Adapt!
He saw the muzzle flashes. With suppressors, they were not as prominent as they would have been without them, but they were enough for Reese to make them out in the darkness. He thought back to the early days in Afghanistan, the automatic weapons gunners shooting unsuppressed at an entrenched enemy position. He remembered the Al-Qaeda guns turning toward the bright flashes of light at the breaks of the 5.56 and 7.62 machine guns, the man's head to his right exploding. Reese knew he should change positions after his first shots, especially since he had now lost the element of surprise and the enemy had him zeroed, but he stayed where he was. What he suspected was that the enemy's IR lasers had been sighted in for a range of 25 yards to a point of aim, point of impact, a cardinal sin. In simple terms, it meant that the lasers would hit what they were aiming at if that target was at 25 yards. He also knew they had a sniper with them. The single round that had impacted him in the body armor had not come from a 5.56 weapon system. If the sniper already had him in his sights, he was a dead man. Observe, orient, decide, act. Settling back in behind his rifle, Reese took a breath and exhaled. He saw the full auto muzzle flash from the suppressed M4 and noted its ineffective hits to his left. He was looking for the sniper. Reese knew he had an advantage. He'd already put targets down and was perfectly dialed for the distance, angle, and elevation, and he knew the wind hold. His antagonist would be taking all those factors into consideration, but had yet to confirm it with a shot. If the Russian sniper missed, he'd make the correction and would not miss again. A single flash, 3 meters to the full auto gun's left, registered in Reese's brain. He estimated back from that flash where the shooter's head would be on the stock of a long-range rifle and pressed the trigger. Vasilyevich heard the report of the large-caliber weapon reverberate off the canyon walls and saw the muzzle flash just as his sniper's head snapped back and away from his Shukhavin, his body collapsing in an unnatural heap. Without looking back up at the cliff, Vasilyevich pushed himself to his feet and retreated into the darkness. Chapter 77. The snow crunched beneath his feet, his nods fogging up from the exertion. He stumbled, fell, got back up, and pressed onward. If only he could make it to the lodge. Vasilyevich's frantic radio calls went unanswered. Sergei never used radios. He despised all trappings of the modern world, and the director was on the hunt, focused on his newest acquisition, the American whose sister he'd killed days earlier.
What was that?
The distinctive sound of Mikhail Kalashnikov's revolutionary invention echoed through the forest. It was too far away to be directed at him. Was it possible one of his men had survived the encounter? His contractors carried M4s. Who on the island had an AK? Then he heard it again. And again. Then it hit him. The Americans were putting AK rounds into the dead bodies of his men. Now Vasilyevich knew what it was to be hunted. His force had been defeated by the Americans. He'd become too comfortable with the night vision and lasers, knowing their adversary wouldn't have the advantage of technology after being hit with the EMP. He'd become overconfident, on home soil with the advantage of surprise and the technical superiority of owning the night. The Americans had made them pay for their hubris. He knew they had taken his forces' helmets and night vision, probably their snowshoes and weapons with IR lasers as well. If only he could get to the relative safety of Alexander's compound, he could contact the Russian military across the bay at Petropavlovsk-Kamchatsky or Avacha Bay and request reinforcements. With the weapons in the lodge, he, Alexander, and Sergei could hold off the invaders until help arrived. Stopping to catch his breath, Vasilyevich nervously scanned the path behind him. He'd be easy to track in the snow, and with early nautical twilight not far off, his pursuers would be able to pick up their pace. He closed his eyes, held his breath, and listened.
There. They were coming.
Keep going. Get to the lodge.
Reese and his team charged through the snow, now outfitted in the snowshoes, helmets, rifles, and nods of their enemy. Reese had warned them that the IR lasers were probably sighted in point of aim, point of impact, at 25 yards, so anything past that distance would be dicey. Devin had his eyes on Ido, who pushed forward on the track of their quarry. Reese took point and had his eyes up and out, looking for threats. It was clear that the Russian was moving toward the lodge, probably to sound the alarm and warn Alexander of the approaching hit team. Reese was intent on him not making it. Devin threw up his left hand, signaling the patrol to stop. He'd seen Ido change his behavior. They were close. Not wanting to walk into another ambush, Reese gave the hand and arm signal for the two trail SEALs to punch out to the right. Farkas and Chavez would move out and ahead to flank their target, putting him in an L ambush and sealing his fate. Reese and Devin waited, quiet and listening for any changes in the environment. Eli took rear security. They'd give their flanking element a solid 5 minutes, and then it would be time for Ido to go to work. They'd caught up quicker than Vasilyevich had anticipated. How many were there? The Russian knew he would never make it to the lodge in time. He would have to outthink them. His plan was a long shot, but one that just might pay off. With a dog on his track, he'd double back, circling around and run parallel to them, closing the distance while moving in the opposite direction, essentially doing a large U-turn. The dog's nose would be on the track. If he could make the move before his pursuers noticed he was veering to his right, he just might have a chance. The tubes on these particular nods were not the best for peripheral vision. It was like looking through two toilet paper tubes. Everything within those tubes was lit up in hues of green, white, and black. To see right or left, his head had to physically turn in those directions. He hoped that because they were exerting themselves to catch him before he got to the lodge, they would be too focused on making time through the snow rather than on the possibility their prey might be trying to outwit them with such a risky maneuver. By the time they figured out he was not going for the lodge, he'd have the drop on them. The two Americans and the lone Russian saw each other at the same time. Farkas was in the lead. His weapon came up quickly as he took the safety off, finger to trigger, but not fast enough for the Russian coming directly for him, who dove into his first available cover. "Contact front!" Farkas yelled to Chavez, who immediately joined him online, both operators melting into the closest trees to evaluate the situation.
"He was doubling back on us," Farkas said, now in a hushed voice.
"You keep him pinned," Chavez said. "I'm going to punch right. Let's finish this guy."
"Roger," Farkas confirmed.
"Moving,"
Chavez said.
"Move."
Before he could take a step, a Russian F-1 hand grenade landed in the snow, just shy of his cover. Reese, Devin, and Eli heard the explosion.
"Shit, he was doubling back on us!" Reese exclaimed.
"Oldest trick in the book," the former SEAL commander thought. "Should have anticipated that."
"Send him," Reese ordered.
Without a second thought, Devin said, "Fass," German for bite, and Ido charged toward the enemy. Vasilyevich angled his head out from behind the tree. He could see that both Americans were down but still moving. He'd finish them and then sprint toward the lodge. The snowshoes were a bit cumbersome, but his remaining pursuers would have the same issue, and they just might proceed more cautiously now that he'd shown them he could exploit his tactical advantages just as well as they could. He was just getting to his feet when it felt like he was hit in the side with a sledgehammer. Ido had been born and bred for this very task. While some dogs longed to chase tennis balls or retrieve ducks, Ido wanted nothing more than to kill terrorists. Though this one didn't smell or taste the way the ones had on his past trips to the warmer places with the one they called Devon, he knew this was his target. His job was to destroy the man before him, and Ido knew how to do just that. Rhys, Eli, and Devon were within 20 yards when they finally had a clear line of sight to the struggle between man and beast. They saw the Russian make a move to draw something from his waistline. Gun or knife, it didn't matter. 3 lasers found his head, the warriors depressing their triggers in the same instant, each sending deadly projectiles into the brainstem of their target, who dropped straight into the snow.
"Here,"
Devon ordered, bringing Ito back to his master as Eli moved to the 2 downed seals. Chavez was getting up, just a little dazed from the blast.
"You okay, buddy?"
Rhys asked, looking in his eyes and then doing a once-over of his body to ensure he still had all his fingers and toes.
"I'm good. Snow tamped the majority of the blast, but Farkas was closer. I'll go take care of our plausible deniability," he said, unslinging the AK from his back and walking toward what was left of the dead Russian.
Eli was stuffing a wound on Farkas's upper leg with gauze below a tourniquet. Even through his nods, Rhys could tell it was a bad one. Farkas was conscious and gritting his teeth to stay quiet.
"Farkas, you are going to make it? That shrapnel missed your arteries, so it's not an arterial bleed. You have a bunch of small shards of shrapnel in there. It just hurts like hell."
"Take these," Eli said, handing the wounded SEAL a handful of pills.
"They will ward off infection, and we'll have you out of here and back to an ER in Alaska before they wear off."
While Eli practiced medicine, Rhys reached into Farkas's pack and pulled out the small Kifaru Wubi, a 21st-century private sector version of the venerable military poncho liner. He extracted it from its small built-in stuff sack and wrapped it around the wounded frogman. Next, he pulled out the Sitka Gear flash shelter and wrapped that around the puffy poncho liner.
"This isn't perfect, but it will keep you from freezing to death out here. We'll be back. I need everybody for this assault. The lodge is just a click east."
Rhys thought of Hannah and Rafe. Though he hated to do it, he was not going to be able to leave a member of the team behind to tend to Farkas. If they failed, Farkas was a dead man, if not from the Russian military assets that would descend on the island, then from the freezing temperatures of Medni and the infections that were bound to set in as soon as the antibiotics wore off.
"Crush them, sir. Don't worry about me. I have rear security," he said, holding up his rifle.
Rhys nodded. The other members of the assault force were primed to execute, the familiar look of resolve on their faces. Before storming on toward the target, Rhys looked down at the smallest member of the team, the multipurpose canine who had saved his life yet again. The dog was chewing on something. It was a chunk of Captain Karyavin Vasilyevich's triceps.
Chapter 78. Rafe moved toward high ground, faster now that the sun was about to break the horizon.
"Was Rhys really on his way to Russia? Or was it just another one of Zhakov's sick mind games?"
The image of his sister's dismembered head floating in formaldehyde burned in his mind, the hate keeping him warm. He squeezed himself into a rock outcropping and surveyed the terrain behind him. Weather was coming in off the Bering Sea. That might work to his advantage. He squinted back the way he had come and could just make out the monstrous 6x6 vehicle pushing through the tundra and snow, slowly gaining elevation in the early morning light. A snowmobile with a single skid in front followed a short distance behind. He knew he had been easy to follow. Now it was time to bait a trap of his own. He looked over the snow-strewn cliffs to the jagged rocks that met the sea at their base, and then carefully backtracked out the way he had come. Alexander brought the Kamaz troop transport to a stop, the tracks in front of him moving toward the very same cliffs where the sister had met her fate. Shaking his head, he grabbed his Raven crossbow from the seat beside him. Sergei and the dogs would deal with anyone who survived his contractors well before they made it to this elevation. He wanted to test himself on this hunt. He'd only bring the dogs up as a last resort.
"What tricks do you have up your sleeve?"
Alexander swung down from the off-road vehicle's lowest step and detached his snowshoes, feeling excitement building inside him.
Finally, a worthy adversary.
Alexander ran his tongue along his upper lip, his eyes tracing the footsteps through the snow.
Don't make this easy on me, Rainsford.
He cocked his crossbow and inserted a bolt into the flight groove of his weapon before stepping off into the snow in search of his prey. Chapter 79. With Farkas out of the fight, the assault team now consisted of four seasoned operators and a dog. They would usually hit a compound like this with 40 assaulters, air assets, a blocking force, and a QRF on standby. On the plus side, Reese didn't have some Remph squawking questions in his ear from back at the Tactical Operations Center. Eli had maneuvered to the back of the building to catch any squirters who might head for the hills during the assault. As the most valuable member of the team with medical skills rivaling any ER doctor, keeping him out of the initial entry was the smart call. Reese noted the surprising lack of security as they approached the entrance under cover of darkness. Was it possible the intel was correct, and the security element they'd eliminated were the only ones on the island? The 10 dead contractors would fit with the numbers from the agency target package. Still, Reese had grown skeptical of all intel that was not generated at the tactical level. They stacked on the door and Chavez took point, finger on the trigger, off safe, with Devon and Ito just behind him. Reese took rear security, giving him the best situational awareness. Had this been a sanctioned mission with the support apparatus that accompanies a special mission unit operation, Ito would have had a small camera attached to his harness, allowing Devon to see what was going on inside without committing assaulters. In this case, they didn't know how many people were in the target building, and they needed to get to Hannah and Rafe before the alert went out that might get them killed. This was an in extremis hostage rescue operation. Unlike a capture-kill, they would bypass potential threats to get to the hostages. A dog in this situation could end up being a liability, but with only four operators, they needed Ito to lead them directly to the hostages. Reese squeezed the back of Devon's left leg, indicating it was time to put Ito to work. Devon reached into his cargo pocket and pulled out a small Ziploc bag. Opening it up, he removed a piece of a dirty T-shirt belonging to Rafe he'd asked Annika for before they'd left Montana. He would have preferred to have one of Hannah's, but this was the best they could do. Putting the scent-infused clothing to Ito's nose, Devon whispered in German, "Revera," and opened the door. The entry was not even locked, once again raising the hair on the back of Reese's neck. Could this be an ambush? Too late for that, they were committed. Ito broke the threshold, Chavez entering immediately left, weapon up, ready to work. Devon went right, taking his corner and sweeping his rifle back just past the center of the room. Chavez was doing the same. Reese was right behind them, moving left to Chavez's side and taking the center of the room first. Clear. They didn't need to speak. Motions and instincts instilled from hundreds of raids and thousands of training exercises made the flow of clearing rooms second nature. Moving. Follow the dog. They moved past the foyer into the great room that was part dining area and part trophy room. Light was beginning to crack the horizon, but the nods were still the most effective way to penetrate the darkness. The remnants of a fire smoldered in an imposing stone fireplace. Ito tore through the game room. He'd alerted. Rafe was close. The assaulters followed Ito across the room, their movements smooth, natural, manhunters in their natural environment. Focused on the door at the far corner of the room, Reese subconsciously noted the animals that adorned the walls. He shot past a tiger rug in front of the fireplace, moving between a South American jaguar looking down from its perch across from a snow leopard on the opposite wall doing the same. A full-body polar bear guarded the doorway through which Ito led the team. A walrus was mounted just across from the majestic white Arctic beast. "Does this guy hunt anything that's not endangered?" Reese thought. "What an asshole."
They followed Ito through the door and into a narrow stone staircase leading into darkness. Reese gave the squeeze and the foursome started to descend, Chavez leading the way, Ito right behind. Reese was last in line, keeping his rifle pointed up toward the door behind them. The stairs terminated in a locked steel door. Ito had clearly alerted on it, and Reese prayed that Hannah was with her brother on the other side. Reese gave Chavez the signal to breach. Ordinarily, they would explosively breach it from the top of the stairs, using the thick walls as protection from the overpressure. In this case, breaching charges were conspicuously missing from the loadout. Chavez slung his weapon and reached behind him for the hooligan tool. Studying the inward opening door, he cursed to himself, wishing he'd brought along the sledge. But when a small band of operators invade a country from 35,000 feet, you can only bring so much. Reese, Ito, and Devon backed up a couple of steps to give Chavez room. Whoever was on the other side would know well in advance that they were coming. In a hostage scenario, that was the last thing you wanted. They were giving up the advantage of surprise. Once the door was ajar, they doubled down on violence of action. Chavez inserted the hooli into the jam and, using its claws, started to pry. The door was solid. The rock wall into which it was built was not. Identifying the weakness, Chavez attacked the area where the locking mechanism met the wall. The stone began to crumble. After a minute, the entrance began to give way. Chavez seized the opportunity and turned the tool around, slamming the duckbill, designed to ram, into the lock again and again. The noise reverberated up the stairway, steel meeting steel. Chavez grunting with exertion as he gave the effort everything he had. One final swing and the door flew open on its hinges. Chavez flattened himself against the wall, making room for Devon, Reese, and Ito to make entry. Devon went left and Reese hooked around to the right, clearing his corner and sweeping back past the center of the room. Silence.
"Clear right," Reese whispered.
"Clear left,"
Devon confirmed.
"Wait, what the—"
Reese said aloud. "Belay that." Ito had sprinted to the end of the room and was barking at the wall. Only, it wasn't. What had at first appeared to be a wall under the alien illumination of the nods was in fact a series of bars, and not just bars, prison cells. The three operators read the room as a professor of literature would a classic novel. They pushed down the left wall, covering the cells with their weapons, sweeping back and forth across the uncleared area. "Movement. Hold fire," Reese commanded. "I'm hitting the light. Stand by. Moving."
"Move,"
Chavez said. Reese took a few steps into the center of the room, flipped up his nods, and pulled down on a string attached to a single light bulb. The room was sparse, rock floor and walls, solid wood beams across the ceiling. 8 prison cells were built against the opposite side of the room. The three commandos kept their weapons trained on the unknown, quickly processing the scene. 8 cells. 6 occupied. 2 unoccupied. No Rafe, no Hannah. The prisoners all huddled in the back corners of their cells, trying to determine if the new intruders were friends or foes. "Chavez, Devon, clear the rest of the house with Ito. I think it's empty, but make sure. Then, Devon, you switch out with Eli. I need him in here ASAP. Take up security with Ito. I'm going to see what intel I can get from these guys. Eli and I will prep them to move. We can't leave them here. We have to assume reinforcements are inbound. This time, it's not going to be a few contractors. It's going to be a full-on Russian military response. Take these prisoners to extract. They might be the only witnesses to what's happened here, and if this goes public, we will need them to keep us off the noose."
"Hey, boss,"
Chavez said from the far end of the room. The change in his tone was chilling. He was standing by a table that had been moved in front of the last cell, a cell that was now empty. A large glass jar, almost the size of a water cooler jug, was on top. Reese walked toward it, a sense of dread building the closer he got. Knowing what it was, even before he stopped, he knelt down and came face to face with Hannah Hastings.
"What are you going to do?"
Chavez asked. Reese felt the hate welling up from the deepest recesses of his soul. He looked from Hannah's upturned eyes to those of his friend and teammate.
I'm going hunting.
Chapter 80. Reese ran in snowshoes, finding his rhythm, the Eccles Legend rifle cradled in his grasp. He had reloaded with 4 rounds in its magazine and a 5th in the chamber. 5 additional rounds on its cheek pad gave Reese quick access to more ammunition and put his eye at the optimal height behind the scope. He'd traded his battlefield pickup for his bolt-action Eccles because he wanted a tool he was comfortable with if he had to make a long shot. According to the African prisoners in Zharkov's dungeon, the Russian hunter and his accomplice had started tracking Rafe when it was still dark, which meant he had at least a 2-hour head start. In all likelihood, Reese would have to even up that distance with a bullet. He'd thought the team might mutiny when he told them he was forging ahead without them. He'd convinced them that with his sniper rifle and with only 2 targets still in play, he was best equipped to handle them. Reese stressed that they needed to get back to Farkas, and it would take the 3 of them to move him to extract. 2 would carry the wounded seal, and 1 would be on security, while also accounting for the Africans. They'd have to rotate positions as they maneuvered overland to the Albatross and Freedom. While all that was true, Reese also knew that anyone who stayed was probably not leaving the island. Going after Rafe and Alexander meant they would surely miss the extract window. He couldn't live with the deaths of more of his friends and teammates on his conscience. He would continue alone. Reese had dropped most of his gear for added mobility. He needed to move. His half-face Hunter Skinner and Winkler Sayok R&D Hawk were on his belt. A SIG P320 compact was in a Black Point tactical wing holster at his side. The path was easy to follow. The tracks were from a 4-wheel drive built to crawl over the snow and rock-strewn landscape. The snowshoes kept him from potholing into the deeper patches of snow as he gained elevation. His labored breathing and the howling wind all but eliminated his sense of hearing. Dawn had broken to an overcast sky. It would be snowing soon. He had to catch up with Rafe and Alexander before the weather closed in, concealing their tracks. The jar containing Hannah's head was seared into Reese's memory. The man responsible was at the end of the trail. It was time for him to die. Reese's peripheral vision caught a blur of white to his right. On instinct born of a warrior's DNA, he pivoted and threw up his left arm to block his face, the dog's teeth sinking into the fabric of his jacket and piercing the skin beneath. Dog! Losing his balance on the snowshoes that had just turned from an asset into a liability, he dropped his rifle and spun the massive canine around into the snow. The primal growls of the beast so close to his face flipped a switch in the former commando. His 5-meter target had just become this animal intent on killing him. Forcing the dog down in the powder, Reese took the mount position and fired a palm strike against his own arm, slamming his radial bone deep into the dog's mouth to take away the jaw's mechanical advantage and prevent it from shredding his arm to pieces. Having been taught to defend against dogs bred and trained to kill, Reese shot a 2nd palm strike into its sensitive nose before going for his pistol. With his arm blocking the dog's face, Reese raised the SIG toward its brain. The thrashing animal was not accustomed to being on its back, which made an accurate shot difficult even at contact distance. To prevent a pistol stoppage from the mess that the animal's hair, skin, and bones were about to cause, Reese braced his thumb on the back plate and fired 1 round into its head, ignoring the instantaneous ringing in his ears from the close shot. Reese pushed clear and struggled to get the awkward snowshoes back under him while attempting to clear his self-induced malfunction from the contact shot. Before he could rack the slide, the 2nd dog hit him in the ribs, sending the SIG into the snow. Fuck! How many dogs do these guys have? As Reese reoriented toward his newest threat, he had another chilling thought
Where is his handler?
Reese adjusted to the new larger dog and tried to rip the snowshoes off his feet. The dog lunged, its sharp teeth finding purchase near Reese's collarbone, ripping with its head but coming away with only bits of jacket. With one snowshoe now free, Reese swung it at his new aggressor, the terrain in the animal's power keeping the seal on his knees as it charged in again. Grabbing for anything he could, Reese pushed one arm into the dog's muscular chest and wrapped his hand around its left leg. Feeling the teeth sink into his shoulder, Reese remembered the weakest part of a multipurpose canine. He grabbed the animal's front legs and snapped them apart like a wishbone, breaking the dog's base. Its primal bark instantaneously became a painful whimper. Rolling around as he would a human on the jiu-jitsu mats, Reese clinched its head and wrapped his arm around its neck, putting it in an anaconda choke. The dog thrashed and pawed in desperation before depleting the last measure of its strength and going limp in Reese's arms. Falling to his back, Reese sucked in precious oxygen. He took stock of his injuries while noting how much longer it took to choke out a dog than a human.
The handler, I need to find my Sig.
Reese scrambled to his feet, the one snowshoe still attached to his foot, making standing a tougher proposition than usual. Scanning the immediate area, Reese froze. A sound he knew all too well permeated the ringing in his ears, the sound of an action cycling on a bolt gun. He turned toward it and found himself looking at a huge man in skins and furs. He was holding a 300 Winchester Magnum. It was at his hip, pointing directly at Reese. Chapter 81. Reese watched as the bear of a man ran the bolt, sending a cartridge into the snow. His face remained expressionless as he cycled the action once more, ejecting another round. He then moved the rifle to his shoulder. Click. Reese inadvertently flinched at what had just become the loudest sound in the world, a firing pin going forward on an empty chamber. The beast smiled as he turned the rifle around and, holding it by its barrel, swung it like a bat, letting it fly off into the snowy tundra. Reese dropped back to a knee, fumbling with the clasp on the snowshoe, in a desperate attempt to free his foot, the monster slowing his approach, as if to give Reese time. The snowshoe free, Reese went for the blade at his belt, but was stopped by a spinning back kick which sent him careening into the ground, hitting his lower back on a rock hidden just beneath the fresh coat of snow. Who is this guy? A spinning back kick coming with such speed from a man of that size was not a good sign. He's comfortable here, Reese thought, getting back to his feet and shooting in for a double leg takedown. His opponent sprawled, then spun to take Reese's back, lifting him up until his hips were over his head, slamming him down like a rag doll. Reese's face met the snow, which luckily softened the impact.
Sambo, Reese thought. Russian military.
His opponent backed off, allowing Reese to start to stand.
He's toying with me.
The Russian then moved in with an agility Reese had not seen in years, taking Reese back down with a scissor sweep, then recovering in the mount position. Reese covered his face in a vain attempt to block the blows that rained down from above. He heard the Russian laugh, saying something in his native tongue that Reese couldn't understand. An image of Rafe's head in a glass container next to his sister's appeared in Reese's mind. Reese thrust his hips up, surprising the gigantic Russian and moving him forward. That move gave Reese the space he needed to draw his blade. Twisting up on his left side and scooting right, Reese plunged the sharp steel into the Russian's hip, then slammed his free hand into the back of the hilt to drive it in as far as possible. Writhing in pain, the Koryak warrior pushed Reese away, giving them both time to stand. A mutual respect for the fighting prowess of the other caused a slight tactical pause. His smile and laughter gone, the Russian drew a large skinning blade from his belt and watched as Reese's right hand moved behind his back, returning with his Winkler R&D hawk in a hammer grip, his left hand still holding Chavez's gift. Both men knew only one of them was leaving this desolate patch of terrain alive. The sharp weapons felt at home in Reese's hands, the grips designed to offer a hold even when awash in the blood of enemies. The two fighters moved toward each other, the Russian using his reach to his advantage, attempting to slash at Reese's stomach. The American anticipated the move. Reese's short blade connected with the larger man's arm, drawing a superficial wound. Reese used his momentum to swing the tomahawk at the Russian's head. Sergei evaded by swaying left, ready to press the attack. Recovering from his missed swing, Reese bent his knees to change levels and hooked his axe behind his target's ankle. He yanked back, sweeping the Russian off his feet. Capitalizing on his dominant position, Reese rushed in to destroy his opponent, but the Russian threw up his feet and used them, along with Reese's momentum, to throw the smaller man over his head.
"This is why you train, Reese. Push the offensive, capitalize on his first mistake, and kill him."
The native Siberian closed the distance and re-entered with a massive downward slash. Reese blocked it by striking his attacker's forearm with the shaft of the tomahawk, and in a move he'd learned studying the Filipino martial arts, hooked his opponent's arm with the beard of the weapon, swinging it down and away. The violent motion ripped his tomahawk down his opponent's arm and through his knife hand in a move known as disarming the snake. Sensing the Russian was both surprised and off balance, Reese swung his left hand around and planted his blade squarely in the large man's clavicle. Reese moved off center line and swept the Russian off his feet, which also inadvertently ripped the knife still stuck in the Russian's collarbone from Reese's hand.
"Finish it."
Leading with the axe, Reese moved to end the fight, but was blasted back with a powerful kick from the Russian.
"Don't get careless, Reese. Close the distance, get inside his range, take that advantage from him."
Pushing the axe head down in his hand into a punch grip, the bottom of the axe head resting on the top of Reese's fist, he squared off again. Sergei entered with a jab.
"Mistake."
Reese used his left elbow to guide the punch directly into the spike of the hawk, splitting the Russian's hand in two. Howling in pain, a look of madness in his eyes, Sergei fired a reverse punch at Reese's head with his uninjured hand. Reese covered and crashed in, punching the head of his axe into the Siberian's face, taking off the bottom of his nose and leaving part of his cheek dangling and exposed. The Siberian attempted another futile, rage-filled swing, but Reese passed his opponent's arm with the shaft of his axe and darted in to clutch his enemy's head, digging the back spike of the hawk into his neck. Taking his other hand, Reese clinched him close, bumped his hips, and took the huge Russian to the ground, landing with his right knee on his chest. In full survival mode, Sergei wrapped the axe with his one massive working hand, gripping it for dear life. Unable to use his most formidable weapon, Reese reverted to a palm strike to the side of the Russian's head and followed it with an elbow. Seeing his blade still protruding from his enemy's collarbone, Reese grabbed the exposed hilt and ratcheted it back and forth like a joystick. Primordial screams of pain erupted from the large man as the vicious blade cut deeper. Reese pushed it downward toward the subclavian artery, pleural sac, and the top of the lungs, trying to force a tension pneumothorax. Sensing what Reese was trying to do, the Russian moved his enormous fist to the seal's left hand, which was working the blade into his body.
Another target.
Reese sliced through the Russian's last functional hand. He turned the blade over and pressure cut across his neck and throat before planting the blade into the left eye socket. Slippery with blood, Reese drew back the axe and used his hip to bump the axe to a hammer grip. He then raised it and chopped it directly into his adversary's skull. Quickly ripping it free, he continued to cycle full-power blows to the head and neck, driven by a vision of Hannah's upturned eyes, her hair floating around her severed head. In one last attempt at salvation, the giant rolled over, wrapping up Reese's ankle. This exposed his side and back, giving Reese new targets, which he attacked with a vengeance. The seal continued his onslaught until the axe severed his antagonist's spinal cord with a strike to the base of the neck. Exhausted and steaming from the fluids evaporating into the cold air, Reese sank back on his heels, enveloped in a fog of death. He closed his eyes and steadied his breathing before kneeling on the Russian's face and ripping the blade from his eye. There was still work to be done. Chapter 82. Alexander deliberately followed the tracks, aware that he was not pursuing a sub-Saharan savage, but a highly trained hunter and man of war. He wouldn't find Rainsford cowering in fear at the end of the trail like he did so many of those imported from the African continent, half frozen to death in a foreign land, no. Rainsford would be thoughtful. He'd be tricky.
"Put yourself in his shoes,"
Alexander mused.
"Where would you go? What would you do? Rainsford was a military man. What did military men the world over do? When pressed, they went to the high ground and they flanked. Two of the basic tenets of warfare, confirmed time and time again throughout history."
"Or would Rainsford know I know this, and do something only an amateur would do because I won't expect it? Will he be waiting for me in my bedroom when I return tonight? Look, he's going to the same point where his stupid sister thought she could hide, no doubt hoping the weather would cover her tracks. She hadn't counted on the dogs. Maybe he isn't either. Soon enough, I'll put this bolt through your heart, S. Rainsford, and I'll mount your head in a jar right next to your sister's in my sleeping quarters."
Rafe watched his tormentor from the rocks 50 feet above. He'd gone as far as he could in the snow, stopping at a place where he could rock climb toward a cave in the side of the cliff. His ruse was intended to make the Russian think he had found refuge there. Instead, he had backtracked out until he made his way to a section of the snow and rock-strewn mountainside that allowed him to leave his trail. He had carefully picked his way up the slope, using rocks, ice, and the occasional exposed root to hide his tracks.
"Hope is not a course of action, I know, but sometimes it's all we have."
He watched as the man who hunted him edged closer to the cliff's edge. He could sense the calculations going through his mind, attempting to anticipate Rafe's moves. Rafe had seen the contractors, heard the dogs. Without a weapon or proper clothing, his odds of surviving the night were slim. The man below had hunted his sister on this very patch of earth. Rafe imagined her terror in those last moments of life, pursued by this madman, his native tracker and hunting dogs. If he was to avenge her, he might not get another shot. Alexander's eyes followed the tracks until they left the snow for the rock of the cliff face. He imagined the route Rainsford and his sister had taken to the cave, inching their way across to what they believed was sanctuary. Was he going to spend the night in there? Was he just getting out of the elements, preparing for the coming storm? The Russian's eyes slowly moved back from the cave along the cliff face to the tracks just to the right of his feet, then back in the direction of his vehicle. His quick step to the rear probably saved his life. A football-sized rock connected with his shoulder instead of his head and sent him crashing into the snow.
"Rainsford! My weapon!"
Alexander scrambled to his knees. Crawling to his crossbow, he brought it to his shoulder, his eye finding the scope as Rafe Hastings descended from above in a controlled fall. Rafe flew down the rock face, his feet finding just enough purchase to direct his movement as he hurled himself toward his sister's killer. He felt the arrow take him in the right shoulder, its broad head pierced tissue and penetrated bone, his right arm immediately incapacitated. His target struggled to get to his feet, fumbling with a second bolt from his quiver. Rafe's left foot found a solid stone, planted firmly, and launched him into his antagonist, sending both of them over the edge of the precipice. Chapter 83. 15 feet to the right, and they would have both been killed on the jagged rocks. Instead, they went over the edge onto a scree slope just shy of vertical. Rafe felt Alexander take the brunt of the first hit as his body connected with a protruding rock, sending them careening toward the sea. Rafe's face made contact with the earth, and he momentarily lost consciousness, his frame briefly becoming a ragdoll. He came to as his already disabled arm shattered against a rock just before he splashed into the knee-deep surf, his leg twisting into an unnatural position with an audible snap.